This is the fifth week. So you've managed to hang in there for a whole month now. Well done. Do you know the significance of offering betel leaves? Do you know how tremendously meritorious it is? This is a tradition that has been passed down generation to generation. And it goes hand in hand with our culture, isn't it? Sri Lankan culture. So you see this tradition in most homes. The betel leaf represents vitality. It represents longevity, depending on context. So it is also something that is exchanged for the New Year, the Sinhalese and Tamil New Year. So depending on the context, it symbolizes something that is significant culturally. And when you offer betel leaves or an assortment of betel leaves to a monk and make an invitation to, well, it's an invitation to do something. Why betel leaves? Why not something else? Why is it not a tray of flowers? We offer the flowers to the Buddha, but you offer betel leaves to the Swaminarayan. See, the betel leaf represents something that we have been gifted with. Do you know the Sinhala word for this? Bulat. It represents something that you have received. That is why it has the suffix lat. What is lat in Sinhalese? To receive something, right? And the prefix is bu. Now, this is not a lesson in Sinhalese or a language lesson. You've come here for a very different purpose. But I want, you know, whenever we do things, ladies and gentlemen, it makes a lot of sense if we do it understanding what we're doing. If we understand the meaning behind these things, then you can all rejoice in it. That is why last week we ended the talk on sharing with you the story, the reason we go on alms, if you recall from last week, why we do it. It's not an adventure for me, but it's to take them on an adventure, the adventure that you have come this far. So the prefix bu represents, what do you think it represents? In this context, it represents Buddhahood. It represents enlightenment. Now, one of these days I will explain to you how some of these words have come into being. There's a lot of meaning behind virtually everything we do. Sometimes we don't know what they are, we just take it for face value. We learn it and we run with it. But sometimes if we stop to question why certain things have come down in certain ways and why some traditions have evolved in the ways they have. In fact, our ancestors knew these things. Sometimes you might have heard them from your grandmother. You know, when you were younger, as she fed you, washed you, she might have told you stories about how our traditions evolved and how things came into being. But, of course, you know, people have lost interest in most of those things. What people are more interested in now is about the future rather than the past. We've forgotten our history, we've forgotten our roots, we've forgotten where we've come from. I'm not saying that history itself is significant, just the fact that it happened in the past. But what I'm saying is, people back in the day did things with a lot of meaning. And that is why our forefathers were healthier than we are today. That's why they lived longer than we did. That's why they lived happily and much happier than most of us do today. So from time to time, when I get the opportunity, I will share with you some of these things. But they're not the be-all and end-all of it. We are here for a very different reason. We are not here to study history or tradition or culture per se. But I think you'll be very interested to understand how some of our cultures and traditions have evolved and how and what their relationship is with the Dhamma. Because our people of the past, they had a very close relationship with the Dhamma. A very close relationship. Gamai Pansalai Vavai Dagabai. You've heard of this, right? So they didn't have the desires that most of us do today. They were very limited desires. And that was because of their association with the Mahasangha. Those days, the great kings, they used to take counsel from the Mahasangha. You've heard lots of stories of how King Kosala and Suddhodana and so on, Bimbisara, used to go to the Buddha to take counsel. Because they wanted to lead and reign righteously. So people back in the day lived happier. So anyhow, that's not something we've lost entirely. You know, but I'm not here to change the world. I'm here to change your world, not the world out there. So the story of Bulat offering betel leaves is an invitation to preach to us the Dhamma that helps us to enlighten. So whoever gets the opportunity to make that offering, I will invite them to do so with that knowledge, with that understanding in mind. Now what about the rest of you? Because you can only offer one of these. Have you heard of the story of Anathapindika? The great man who lived in the past, who was the chief benefactor of the Sasana, and he offered the Jetonarama. It is said that when Anathapindika offered the Jetavanarama, in return for his merits, a silver palace was created for him in the heavenly abode. Now, some of you might think this is superstition, others might believe in some of this, but that's besides the point. The point here is, there was a man who was a bystander. He was just observing what was going on. He put his hands together and said, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Just observing what was going on. Do you know what he received for his merits? A golden palace. See, the beauty of the Buddha Sasana, ladies and gentlemen, is we learn how to engage in merits without having to spend a penny, without having to actually physically be in contact with things. Remember, last week I told you, sometimes when we are driven past, particularly, you know, the Colombo town and some of the suburbs, I see houses the size of palaces. And I rejoice in them. I love to see them. Not because I have a strange interest in architecture, but I look at them and go, how much merits people must have done. What merits people must have done to earn things like this, to have received something like this. So I really enjoy observing, looking at successful people, be that in health or wealth. However, you know, we have come to somehow, you know, some people, they look at them and, you know, they feel jealous. I think that's just the wrong take on all of it. Some people look at them and go, dirty money. I don't think it has to be that way. Why can't we rejoice in someone's, you know, benefit, in someone's advantage? Why can't we rejoice in that? Because, you know, it might be that someone's done something demeritorious to acquire that wealth, but the fact that they receive wealth is because of merits they've done in the past. So I, for one, I really enjoy to watch people become successful and see the riches that they're able to earn and the wealth that they're able to accumulate and acquire, but I enjoy something even more than that. I enjoy watching them engaging in merit by using what they have. Because I know that two things. One, they are doing what they've done before. So therefore, they are creating the path for more wealth to come their way, more success to come their way. Because in giving, we receive. That's it. It's simple as that. And secondly, it gives me an opportunity to rejoice. But I don't have a penny to spend. I don't have a cent to spend. However, I'm today capable of watching something meritorious happen right in front of my eyes and just go sadhu sadhu. I want you all to be able to do the same. Perhaps, you know, you might see a monk going on Pindapatha. You might see someone offering that. Remember last week we talked about the gift of giving? Yeah? So you don't have to necessarily give. You can give the gift of giving, can't you? So now we understand how we can do that. We give someone else the chance to give. What a great giving that is. How many people can actually engage in something like that and actually be happy about it? So that is what bulat is. That is why you offer betel leaves at the beginning of a talk. It is an invitation to whoever. It could be a Swamin Mahansi, it could be a Gihi Upasaka Mahatya doing a talk. But ultimately it's an invitation to enlighten us. It is symbolized by the betel leaf. So from next time, where whoever offers that, I want for all of you in your hearts, you don't have to shout it out loud if you don't want to, right? But in your hearts, you can rejoice in it by just giving a sadhukara. And making that invitation in your hearts and in your minds. And in doing so, you can also partake in that meritorious deed. Right, before we continue, let us take a moment then to pay homage to the Magnificent One, the Unvanquished One. It is because of He, today we are able to study, understand, comprehend the Dhamma and free ourselves from all suffering. Let us also observe the five precepts, which is an oath that we take to cleanse ourselves, to free ourselves from defilement, and then embark on our journey forward to the supreme bliss of Nibbana. So, let us all chant the Namaskara before we begin. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. I want to continue a conversation we had 1 or 2 weeks ago. I ended on a note, and I think it's high time we continued that conversation. So, remember I asked you this question, is it better to know or not know about the cancer that you have? You know, is it better the cancer that you know or the cancer that you don't know? What do you think? You have a cancer. Is it better that you know about it or better that you don't know about it? It's better you know, right? Why is it better that you know about it? So you can do something about it. Because whether you know about it or not, the cancer is going to do what the cancer is going to do. But if we get to know about it, there's a chance that we can do something about it. We all enjoy pleasures in life. I mean, you know, the ups and downs of life we always talk about, and so much so that it might sometimes feel that, you know, if you didn't have the little pleasures that you enjoy in life, is life really worth it? Now, of course, we all know about the problems that come into our lives, right? The vicissitudes that we have to face from time to time, day to day. Right, the downs of our lives we are all too familiar with. When things don't go right, you know, bereavement in the family, perhaps there's someone in the audience who might have lost someone recently, right? And you know what that feels like. Perhaps there's someone here who expects that to happen sometime soon. Perhaps it's a you know, a parent or a grandparent perhaps. Maybe it's someone that you didn't expect to say goodbye to so soon. Which reminds me of a story. I've shared this with you in the past, and those who have come to the talks at the monastery will know this, but I'll share it with you nonetheless because we talk about the subject of cancer. The first time that someone with a cancer came to see me, folks, they came with their family. And I remember that event to this day because I think the conversation that we had opened up a whole new avenue for a lot of people in the room. So this was the mother of the family. She was quite young, relatively. I think late 30s to early 40s. Came with the family, and they had, I think, two girls and a boy. And so quite young family, teenagers, as you'd expect, and one actually quite a young boy as well. So they've lived quite happily, and things have been going just fine for them until one day they realized that the mother's got a cancer. So she'd fainted one day, they'd rushed her to the hospital, and that's how they'd found out. Now for some of you, some of these stories you might be able to relate to, right? Because you've gone through some of these experiences. In fact, the day I talked about this, one of you in the audience came and shared a personal story. And I said, man, don't worry, I'll help you. That's what we're here for. I can't stop life taking over you, but I can help you to deal with life. Right? If you've already come to the party, I can't stop the drinks. I can't stop what's going to happen. But I can help you deal with it. So that no Mara can come and take your happiness away from you. Right? Come it may death, disease and decay, I can't stop any of that for you. But I can help you fortify your mind and strengthen yourselves so that in the face of any adversity, you can become unshakable. That I give you as a promise. So anyhow, this family, they came to see me, and you can expect that the family was in tears. So as they speak into the Swaminarayana, they're saying, Swaminarayana, you know, this was a complete shock for all of us. We didn't expect anything of this sort. And our mother has been diagnosed, and they can't even spit the word out. You know, it's one of those things, right? When, you know, you really struggle to deal with that. You don't even want to say the word out, it brings a tear to your eye. Sometimes it can be quite a shocker for people. So I said, fine. Now you're all here because you feel that she's counting her last days and she's in a very difficult place. You feel sorry for her, right? So that's why you're here. And you're worried that she's going to die very soon and you're going to lose her as a result of that. I said, fine. Let's do a little bit of an activity. So I asked them to bring me a piece of paper and a pen. And I passed it round the room. So they'd come with some of their friends as well. So there were about 10 or 15 people in the room. And I said, in this piece of paper, on the left-hand side column, write down numbers from 1 to 15, because there were 15 people in the room. And I said, when the paper comes into your hand, write down the order in which you are going to die. Does that make sense? So imagine I gave you a piece of paper starting with this good lady here and pass it down all the way to the back of the room with the number of people in the audience, and I say, write down your name next to the number which represents your order in which you're going to die. How far do you think it went around the room? How far do you think it went? It stopped. It didn't go any further than the first person. Because they took the piece of paper, pencil in hand, scratching their head, wondering, where do I put my name? So I said, let me help you. Let me make this easier, right? We know who's going to be first, surely. Right? You brought your mother with you, who's got the cancer, and you're telling me that she's going to be dying soon, so that's why you're here. You feel sorry for her. You want her to listen to the Dhamma. Right? That's why they brought her. They want her to listen to the Dhamma, so that she can, you know, she can heal herself. Spiritually. They'd never come to the temple before, but they brought their ailing mother. So because they want me to preach to the mother. Not to them. They're fine. They want me to preach to the mother. So I said, fine. So let's put her name as number one, and then the rest of you can follow, can't you? And then again, there's a moment of silence. I ask, why? What's the problem? But Swamin answered, we can't really say that it's going to be her going first, can we? I said, oh, really? But isn't that why you brought her here today? Is it not because she's got the cancer and she's going to be the first to go? Are you not so confident about that? Isn't that why you brought her here and you want me to preach to her? And then they all said, we get the point, Swamin answered, we get the point. We all think that it's going to happen to somebody else. Honestly, ladies and gentlemen, answer this question for me, will you? When you cross the street, right? How many times have you risked your life? But have you never seen someone make the wrong decision? And then an oncoming vehicle, right? It crashes into them, and then, you know, that was the end of their story. How many times have we seen this, but yet we feel that it's not going to happen to us? When you go to a funeral, sometimes it might be to a young person's funeral. You know, maybe they're not very elderly. Perhaps in the middle of their, you know, middle-aged people. Maybe even quite young people. You look at them and you say what? Sinno. I've heard people say this. Ayo, sinno. This young boy. How youthful. What a shame that he has to go so soon. And then what do? At the end of that, after the funeral, we have our meal and then we, you know, have a chit-chat with the rest of the family. And when we come home, and when we just forget about that. And just carry on with life. But in that moment, right, it is a shocker for you. You know, people so young, this can happen to. But, and you begin to wonder, might it? Nah, not to me. You know, we all seem to have this sense of false confidence when it concerns ourselves. How good we are at giving advice to other people. But how seldom do we follow our own advice? Just think about it. Especially when you're doing something risky. There's a reason for this. And as we progress in the Dhamma, ladies and gentlemen, you'll begin to understand why. Why the mind works in these unimaginably, sometimes even foolish ways. If you think about it logically, it makes no sense, some of the things that we do. But in that moment, you feel a sense of confidence that I'm all right. But you better be careful. Watch out. But I'm all right. In fact, you put yourself in the same shoes. You do the same thing. But you feel nothing untoward is going to come to you. There's a reason for that. And the reason is something called jati, which I'm not going to talk about just yet. But we will come to that very soon. It is what the Paticca-samuppada explains. Dependent origination. It is all rooted in ignorance. Jati is a disease that happens in the mind. Like we catch a cold. It is a disease that happens in the body. There are diseases that take over the mind. The Buddha's job was to teach us about those diseases, because without his help, it would have been incredibly difficult. In fact, almost impossible. Not almost, in fact, impossible. To understand the diseases of the mind. We'll unravel some of these as we go further. But so that was the conversation I had about the cancer with the family. And then they realized, you know, they better start looking after themselves as much as they do about the other people in the family. I say this to you because I'm quite proud of the fact that you are all, most of you will be family people. Most of you will be people who have someone else who you are responsible for. Maybe a group of people, maybe an organization, maybe a family. But you're here today because you want salvation. You want salvation. You know that the things you've been doing all this time in your life have not really provided the answers that you sought. You have to agree. In fact, the very reason you're here you know, you heard about it from someone, there's going to be a Dhamma talk. Right? So the Dhamma comes from the Buddha, so it must be something that the Buddha has said. Let's go find out what the Buddha said. Why did you go find out? Why do you need to go find out what the Buddha said? Because he talks about suffering. He talks about the Four Noble Truths. And we've all heard what the First Noble Truth is. What is the First Noble Truth? The Noble Truth of suffering. Then you begin to wonder, okay, hang on. Then, so the Buddha has spoken about suffering. I suffer. There are things in life that make me suffer. So surely he has discovered what suffering is. And then he went on to explain the cause of suffering, the eradication or the cessation of suffering, and the path to cessation of suffering. Excellent. So the Buddha has the remedy for my mental ailments. That is why you're here. In other words, we all admit that we suffer mentally. The reason we suffer mentally is because we're going after happiness. This is the most ironical thing there is. I can't think of anything more ironical than this. Remember last time we spoke about this, I asked you, are you happy or trying to be happy? Remember that conversation we had? So I'm reminding some of the old stuff we talked about because we want to make some headway today. Right? You've been coming along for 4 weeks. I mean, that's quite an achievement. It shows you're serious about this. So I have to give you a test before I give you some of the best things that life has to offer. The fact that you've been coming along for the last 4 weeks is a test that you're in here, you're here for the long run. So which is quite an achievement. Did you have a think about this? Am I happy or am I trying to be happy? Are you still trying to be happy? In life, we're still trying to be happy, aren't we? Someone who's trying to be happy is not what? Is not happy. What are some of the things we do to try and be happy? Now, the other day we talked about cake. Baking a cake, making a cake, right? Putting it in the oven, slicing it up and chewing it. We discovered that none of that was pleasurable. In fact, if I asked you to do it as a job, a daytime job, none of you would sign up for that. But there is that moment when cake touches your tongue, right? And then you experience that lovely sensation, that sugary taste. And that is quite enriching, quite enjoyable. But for how long? Remember, we talked about this. I'm juggling your memory from a few weeks ago because I don't want to talk about the same example again. But I want you to get into that mindset. What are we talking about today? I'm going to reveal to you that the happiness we have been going after is not the true happiness that we ought to. In fact, bear this in mind for the time being and you will understand it in a few moments, ladies and gentlemen. Happiness is not something you need to go get. Happiness is what you will experience when you stop going after it. But until you realize this, you're going to try and make an effort to be happy. Remember, Angulimala ran after the Buddha after he was running after his mother. You know the story, right? And then the Buddha goes and says, he tries to save Angulimala because had he murdered his mother, that would have been a heinous sin, right? And you would not have been able to save him. What we call an Anantariya Papakarma. Why it's called an Anantariya Papakarma? We'll talk about these things later. So, after the Buddha called out to Angulimala, he comes running after the Buddha. Yeah? And he thinks, well, you know, the Buddha is quite fair in complexion. He looks, you know, full-bodied. So, you know, his finger is worth the while. So he comes running after the Buddha and he says, Buddha, stop. Actually, he doesn't know that this is the Buddha. So he just says, stop. He calls out. He screams, stop. You, Shramana, stop. So what does the Buddha say? The Buddha says, Angulimala, I have already stopped. You're the one who's running. Now at this point, Angulimala is confused. As confused as you might be, perhaps, when I said, when I uttered the words, you're unhappy because you're running after happiness. So Angulimala stops, and at that moment, he asks the Buddha, you are a Shramana, and Shramanas don't lie. So why is your moving? Why do you say you have stopped? While you're running, why do you stay? While you're moving, why do you say you have stopped? And the Buddha says, I have already stopped, Angulimala. You're the one who's still running. What does he mean by this? Now, I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, will have learned this maybe in the Dham Parcel or at school, right, for Buddhism. And you've heard of this story. And perhaps in the way that we were taught it, or the way that we understood it, was that the Buddha was talking about physically moving, running, going somewhere. In fact, that's not what he was talking about. What he said was, I have stopped going after happiness. But you are still doing that. You're still going after happiness. You're still pursuing happiness. You're still going after a happiness that you will hopefully receive by doing something, by going after something. But the Buddha says, no, Angulimala, you don't need to do that. Stop and happiness is yours. I have stopped. Why are you still going? So this was the question the Buddha, so it was in fact a riddle that the Buddha put forward to Angulimala. Now Angulimala understood some of it. So he realized that Shramana does not lie. So he, having kneeled down, he says, Buddha, I don't understand what you're saying. Can you explain to me? And then, of course, the Buddha goes on to give a discourse. And at that point, Angulimala realizes that happiness is not something you have to go after. Happiness is with you. If you just stopped going after it, you will realize you've already got it. That is why enlightenment is a realization. It's not a discovery. It's not you, it's not something, it's not like Columbus who went to America and discovered it was there. It's what you realize you have with you if only you stopped looking for it. Now, if you remember some of the examples we used last time, you took the example of cake. Do you remember the example of a mother and her two children going for exams? And you all agreed that coming third in class is better than coming first? Really? Coming third in class is better than coming first, isn't it? Which one makes you happier? That's not the right question, is it, to be asking? What makes you happier is, which one have you been waiting for longer? Which one have you been longing for? Which one have you been vexing for? That is what makes you happy. Then we talked about the airport, how people are greeted in the arrivals lounge and then they're taken home, right? You get the royal treatment on the first day, and the second day, you know, that is not the same, and it starts to dwindle, and then by the end of the week, right, they're just another member of the family and they have to do all the chores, go do the shopping, make the bed, sweep the house and do all the rest of it. And we've started to wonder why it is so. Why is that the case? Then I also talked about, if you recall, how two people who only saw each other on Saturdays or Tuesdays for chemistry class, physics class and maths class, and they thought, I should wait for the next week to go and see her, right? When you first had a crush on someone, right? You may all remember this story, do you? Yes, when you first had that crush and you look forward to that meeting. But you had to wait to see them, and the longer the wait, the more joyful it was when you finally got to see them. But then what you did was you tried to spend more time with them. Yeah? So once a week was not enough, so you somehow managed to see them once a day, and that was not enough, and then you decided, let's both live under one roof. Now you see them every day. So what's happened now? Where did that joy go? Two people who promise each other till death do us part, and then they split up. How do these things happen? You know, these are the mysteries in life. They'll remain mysteries if, unless and until we begin to understand the psychology behind all of this. Why does the mind behave in these ways? You know, if only you could understand why your mind behaves the way it does, ladies and gentlemen, you know, you could live fuller and happier and simpler lives and just be content with life. Until then, you're on a rat race. One after the other, after the other, after the other, always looking for a happiness that is never with you. Or that is always with you, but you think it's somewhere out there. And so you keep going after it. It's like the donkey going after the carrot. You must have seen that, you know, in some pictures they draw it, you know, there's a donkey and they tie a carrot on a stick that's tied to its back. But the carrot is always what? One step ahead of the donkey. So what does the donkey do? Always try to go forward in the hope that it's going to get a bite of the carrot. But the carrot smells sweet. So it can experience the smell of carrot, but it wants to taste the carrot. So it always tries to keep going forward, that, you know, hopeful, ever hopeful, that one day I'll get to take a bite of the carrot. So what do you call someone who does that? Okay. That is what I used to call myself. So enough of this donkey business. I'm here to show you that happiness is yours. You don't have to keep asking someone for it. You don't have to beg someone for it. I feel sorry when a guy kneels in front of a girl and says, "Please make me happy." I mean, you don't have to do that. You know, it's so ironical. It makes no sense to do that. Let me explain it to you. If ever you've done it, or if ever you're planning on doing it, right? Proposing on one knee, "Please make me happy," or "Will you be mine?" Right? If ever you, any of you here, planning on doing that, right? Hear this out and then do it. Because, you know, I don't mind whatever you do, but I just want you to know what you're doing and do it. Then I don't feel bad. At least I feel, you know, I told you so. Right? So hear me out and see whether you agree with me or not. Right? So there's a girl. A guy thinks she's the one who's going to make me happy. Right? Life is not worth living without her. Now the girls can in the room, you can switch roles and think otherwise, right? So if you are the girl, you want to ask the boy out, you know, these days you get all sorts. It doesn't matter. So the guy goes to the girl and says, "Honey." And it's too early to call honey, right? What would you say, "Darling," "Oh, sweetheart, right? You're the one who's going to make me happy, and I can't imagine a life without you. Be mine, and I will make you the happiest, what? Happiest person alive." Right? Where do you get this from? Fairy tales. So read them, Cinderella's and Rapunzel's, and read them all. Read the fairy tales and try and live real life like that. And if you live happily ever after, put your hand up if that has ever happened for you. Live happily ever after. Not a day passed where you didn't have an argument. Not a day passed where you didn't see eye to eye. Not a day. Live happily ever after. When did that ever happen? Only in fairy tales. But you know, that's what we read as kids growing up, right? So you think that is what the world is like. What rubbish. Anyhow. So the girl goes to the boy and says, no, other way around. The boy goes to the girl and says, "Be mine and I will make you the happiest girl alive." If I were the girl, here's what I would think. I told you, I'm not a monk. I'm a scientist in a robe. Okay? So, here's what I would think as the girl. Hang on a second. So this guy says that if I would only be his, he would make me the happiest girl alive. So he must be quite happy to be able to make me happy. If he's so happy, if he's promising me all this happiness that he somehow claims to have, then why does he want me to be his? He's making a false promise. Just think about it. If someone comes up to you and says, "Be mine and I will make you happy," surely they must have happiness to give you, right? That is the promise that they're making. Be mine and I will make you happy. So it's like, you know, I'm going to get the better deal out of it, apparently. So it's like, I'm losing out if I don't say yes to him. I mean, that's what the deal is made to sound like, right? It's like, you know, be mine, otherwise, you know, you're not going to be happy, so you better be mine. But my question is this. If you're so happy, why do you need me to be yours? So much so that if I said no now, if I reject you now, if you ever seen that, you know, sometimes I remember I used to watch on YouTube, like, what do you call them, proposals gone wrong, failed proposals, right? Boy goes and asks the girl, will you be mine? And it's quite embarrassing because, you know, there's people in the room and she doesn't want to say no and crush his heart, but she has to say something. Now it's going to look far too embarrassing, but she can't commit to the relationship and she says, oh, honey, sorry, I don't, you know, we're just friends. So this is the man who promised to make the girl happy. And then what happens to him at that moment? Don't fall for this nonsense. Don't take that class. I wouldn't pay for that class. Your happiness, ladies and gentlemen, is your own making. No one in this world can make you happy. Remember, this Swami Maharaj has not come here to make you happy. I cannot make you happy. I don't have happiness to give you. Here, come and take it. Half a dozen for a dollar. I can't do that. There's no one in this world that can make you happy. Not your mother, not your father. Not your parents, not your teachers. No one can make you happy. The Buddha can't make you happy. No one can make you happy because happiness is not something that someone has to make for you. It's yours. It's with you already. You just need to stop looking for it. That doesn't make sense, does it? You stop looking for it. That is why I said this is the biggest irony. This is the one thing in this world, ladies and gentlemen, if you go looking for it, you will not find it. Everything else in this world, go looking for it and you will find it. Go looking for land, you will find it. Go looking for money and you will find it. Go look for the riches and the wealth, go look for gems, you will find it. Go look for the moon and you will find it. But go looking for happiness and you won't find it. It's one who has stopped looking for happiness, who realizes he is already happy. I'm going to convince the point to you by using a number of examples. And as I relate these examples to you, I want you to live them in your minds. See whether you agree with them. So please don't take anything I say just because I'm a monk, or, you know, you have to just take it. Right? Nothing here should be like that. We are in a laboratory. This is the science lab. Okay, this is the lab of life. So nothing I say you must take just because I say so. I want all of you to be not followers, but students. I'm not saying I'm your teacher. What I'm saying is be a student of life. Take lessons from life. Think about the last time you were happy. You were really happy. You might have had a visitor, a friend from school, maybe a long lost friend, or, you know, someone who you hadn't seen for a while. Perhaps maybe it was your birthday recently and you got given a gift and that made you really happy. Maybe someone announced, perhaps it was your daughter announced that she was pregnant, and now you're going to become a grandmother or a grandfather. Perhaps that made you happy. Or maybe, just maybe, someone in the family was diagnosed with something and you thought it was terminal. But somehow they managed to get treatment and now they are healed and the reports have come back saying negative. Each of these moments were moments that you felt happy, right? In each of these moments, you experienced happiness. So was it the moment that gave you happiness then? This is the question we have to ask ourselves now. See, if there are things in life that makes you happy, shouldn't it make everybody happy? Let me take you back a few years. 30 odd years. No, actually not 30. When did they finish the war that we had in Sri Lanka? How many years ago? 10? 9 years ago. Thank you. Big Bud? 14. 2009, yes. So about 14 years ago. Do you remember that day when they announced? That Prabhakaran was killed. He is neither my friend nor my foe. I'm just giving you a story. Do you remember that day? Do you remember how this country celebrated that day? How our nation celebrated that day? There were fireworks, there were crackers, there were parties, right, all over the country. But not in every home, right? Not in every home. Wouldn't you agree that there were some homes where people were in mourning? Where people thought they had lost their battle for freedom. They'd lost their battle. They'd lost their hero. But the vast majority of the country celebrated. See, even something so significant where the vast majority finds a thrilling moment, a joyful moment, a moment to celebrate, there are still others for whom it was an utter disappointment when they realized all hope was lost. How is it that the same event can make one happy and the other unhappy? If it is the event that makes someone happy, then one event, the same event, should make everyone happy. But that is not so, is it? Any cricket fans? It's a silly question, isn't it? In a room full of what? Asians, Sri Lankans, is a silly question to be asking. Cricket fans. When you watch a game of cricket, remember the 96 World Cup? I remember watching it. I was on the edge of my seat. I remember watching it. A few balls left and we had a few more runs. We needed to win the game. A few balls later, maybe an over later, as the game came to a close, right? And they won the last run. With the last run, they won the Sri Lanka won the game. In your home, there was a celebration. Yeah? But in the homes, maybe 1,000 kilometers from us, in a faraway land called Pakistan, we played against them, didn't we? 96? Yes. Pakistan, right? Sorry? Australia, yes. I beg your pardon. In Australia, in a land called Australia, people were not celebrating. They were disappointed. So why is it that a victory doesn't make everyone happy? Now you'll have an answer, a superficial answer. You'll say it's because, well, you know, Sri Lanka is our country, so we must be happy when Sri Lanka wins. The Australians would have been happy if they won. Surely, Swami knows, that makes sense. My point is this. It is not the victory that makes one happy. It's what you want. If when what happens is what you want, or if what happens is what you want, then you are happy. But if what happens is what you don't want, then you are unhappy. So if you are someone who has wants, I'm not talking about needs. There's a difference between the two. There's a difference between wants and needs. Needs are the things that we need to sustain ourselves, right? We need oxygen to breathe. We don't want oxygen, we need oxygen. We don't want food, we need food, right? We need clothes, we need medicines. These are the four requisites. We need these things. But the things that we want are things that the mind wants. Now, if you had a friend, for instance, maybe say a friend from another country who was watching the game with you on that day, he or she would have also enjoyed that moment when Sri Lanka won because he or she was your friend. And he or she wanted you to be happy, so therefore when you were happy, they were happy. Is it not clear to us then, using this, looking back at the examples that we've discussed? So we discussed the example of the mother with the two children, we discussed the example of eating what you want and being happy about it, we've discussed the example of, you know, greeting someone that you've been waiting for, and we've discussed the example of, you know, the winning team that you wanted to win, right? In each of these instances, ladies and gentlemen, where there's a wanting, there seems to be happiness. Yeah, if you want something and you get what you want, you're happy. Would you all agree with me on that? When you get what you want, you're happy. What is the risk with this? Do you not see a risk here? If you're only happy when you get what you want, what's the risk? What happens when you get what you don't want? Or when you don't get what you want? Then you're unhappy. You're disappointed. If your child fails an exam, that's not something you want, so you're unhappy. If your crush, when you ask the question, says no, if you get a rejection, you're unhappy. If you apply for, well, say you've applied for a visa to go to another country, or you applied for a job and they come back to you with a rejection. So I want you to live these experiences, because we've all lived long enough to have had some of these experiences in our lives. So think back to the time when it happened. Maybe you wanted to buy a property, right? And you had your mind set on it. You had a price going for it, it was all discussed, but in the last moment they said, sorry, you can't have it, another buyer has come and taken it up. Never happened to you? How did you feel in that moment? Disappointed. Why? Because there was something you wanted and it didn't materialize. So don't you feel that this is like walking a tightrope? We have all put ourselves into a position where we are vulnerable. If things go to plan, if things go the way we want, we are happy. But when things don't go the way we want, we are unhappy. In other words, would you not agree then that you have allowed events that happen in and around you to decide whether you are happy or unhappy? So then who gets to decide whether you're going to be happy tomorrow? Well, we've only just started today, so I'll ask you about today, right? Who decides whether you're going to be happy today? Can you? Can you really? Don't you feel somehow that you have no control over your happiness? Is that okay? I mean, are you all right with that? If you are, then, you know, I haven't got much more to say. If you are happy about the fact that someone can control your happiness, if you are happy about that, if you are okay with that, then we don't have much else to talk about. I personally was not happy about that. My exam results determined whether I was going to be happy or not. The job interview determined whether I was going to be happy or not. My friends got to decide whether I was going to be happy or not. When you watch a film, when you watch a drama on TV, there are ups and downs. You go through the motions. There are happy times and there are unhappy times. You know, they know how you work. They know how your mind operates. That's how they make money out of it. That's okay. You can't fault them for that. Because, you know, no one's forcing you to do it. You volunteer your time, you volunteer yourselves. Do you know how you enjoy a film? Would you like me to give you an analysis of that? How it is you enjoy watching a film? Is that all right? Don't tell me I didn't warn you. Because the thing is this, right? Today I'm here because I understood the truth. So I'm about to share with you the truth. So things could happen in your life. Is that okay? Things could happen in your life. I'm not saying all of you should come and live this life. But what I'm saying is, I want you to be happy. You know, you don't have to strive and struggle so hard to be happy. Let me talk you through how our film makes you happy. I used to be a film fanatic. Up until I left my lay life and went to my ordained life, I used to be hitting the box office, always looking out what was the latest movies, what's got the best reviews, right? You name it, I watched it. That's what I used to do on weekends. You go on IMDb, get the rating on which movies are the best rated. But there used to be another one, Rotten Tomato. Any of you tried that? They give you ratings on the best movies. So now you got something from the sermon today. They give you a rotten factor. So it tells you what the best movies are. Take it down, Rotten Tomato. We should all get something from a sermon, right? I'm just jesting. So I used to be a film fanatic. But then I realized how a film makes me happy. And I felt, what's the word? I felt cheated on. I felt cheated. So let me explain to you, as you have given me the liberty to do so. You know, when they start a film, like most films, let's take a Hindi film. Yeah, usually the same story, right? A few nuances, but usually it's a typical story. So at the beginning, they introduce you to a family that's very happy. You know, there's a mother, there's a family, sometimes a big family, like a Thakur who lives, you know, very, very prosperous and wealthy Thakur. Maybe there's a young girl in the family, and she's, you know, she's come of age, so she's looking, her parents are looking for someone for her to get married to. And also there's going to be a boy somewhere, like quite handsome, good looking. Right? And now, when you see the two of them, you know that something's going to happen between them very soon, right? And then, somehow, life would have it, that fortune would have it, that the two of them would meet. Maybe, you know, maybe at some ceremony at the home, or maybe in the village, right? Something happens and the two of them meet. You know, that first glance, yeah? They see eye to eye, that first moment, and the director makes it clear to you that you know what's going on, that there's chemistry between the two of them, right? Now, when you see this, what do you want to happen between the two of them? What do you want for them to be together, right? I mean, otherwise, why would you watch the movie? That's the story that you like to enjoy, right? You want them to be happy. Because, you know, don't we want everyone to be happy? Even if it is in a film, right? Wouldn't it be nice if everyone was happy? So that's what we want. So we want the boy and the girl to be happy. Now, of course, there's always a problem. Usually, the father doesn't like. Oh, because typically the boy is from a poor family. Yeah, I think 90% of Hindi films. No disrespect to them at all. You know, I used to enjoy Hindi films quite a lot myself. Right? 90% of the time, that is what happens. Usually the father doesn't like, or the mother doesn't like. Or there's usually another party involved. So there's another boy who likes the same girl. So you have this equilateral triangle. Right? There are songs written about it. You know them. Samakoni, Trigoni, again. So. Okay. So now, you know, there are three parties involved. There's a boy and the girl. Now, you want them to be together, but there's this other factor that's keeping them from coming close to each other. So you want that factor to be taken out of, because, you know, romance, isn't that nice? You know, so romantic when the boy and girl meet, you know, they should be together. In your mind, you've already thought about, how what a lovely life they'll live together. Oh, and the beautiful children that they'll be making together. This beautiful boy, this beautiful girl. So, as the film moves on, as the story develops, there comes in the villain. So, sometimes the villain is the father of the girl. Sometimes the villain is the village thug. Yeah. Sometimes it could be someone who wants to get money from them. Sometimes they just want to take the daughter, take the girl away, right? But there's a villain somehow. Now, when this villain comes into the picture, what do you want to happen to the villain? Do you want the villain to live happily ever after? No. See, what happened to your compassion then? Where's the loving kindness and compassion? The previous day you went to the temple and you offered flowers to the Buddha and did the Maitri Bhavana. But today you're watching this film and there's a villain and you don't want any good happen to you. You want the villain to be, you know, sorted out. Sort him. Why doesn't someone come and sort him out? So as the story develops, right, now the two of them want to be together, this girl and the boy. In fact, you know, they don't want to be together. They're just acting out a script because they get paid for it. Right? But you want them to be together. So this is what the director's done in your mind. In fact, what he's done is, now we need to watch the movie and we need to do the examination of what's going on. Otherwise, this analysis is the important part, okay? What the director's done in your minds, ladies and gentlemen, is he or she has created what we call a vexation. The vexation of wanting something. This is why you enjoy a film. Okay? Now, you want something. You want the two of them to be together. Even in this story, you know it's a story. But whilst you're watching the story, you sometimes forget that it's a story, don't you? That's why when they cry, yes? Go on. Don't be shy. When they cry, I cry. And when they're angry, I'm angry. I mean, a good director worth his salt should be able to do that. Like they should make it lively for you. If you don't get to enjoy that, at the end of the story, what do you go? Oh, useless. They didn't even have a fight in it. There was no romance in it. There was nothing there to enjoy. What a waste of time. So a good director, that's why they win the Oscars, right? They make you believe that you are part of it. They make you believe that that's your daughter. They make you believe that that's your father, your mother. You know, you are part of it. That's a good director. A good story writer should be able to do that. That is why they're artists and they get paid for that. So as the story develops, now there's the villain and you want the villain to be taken out of the picture, because of course, you know, he or she is stopping the two people that you are very fond of from living together, coming together and living happily ever after, like they say in the fairy tales. So now what happens? Usually there's a fight. I mean, there's no Hindi film without a fight, right? Usually there's a fight. So in the fight, what usually happens? And this is typical. So first of all, as the fight begins, right, the bad guy, he attacks the good guy. So the hero gets hit by the villain. And then, you know, sometimes they give them a fist punch and then they go and land in the other part of the country. Right? Right? And then somehow they come running back and then the fight continues. And here's what happens at one point. At one point, it seems like the good guy is going to win. Yeah, so the good guy gets the upper hand and then he beats the bad guy down and then it looks like it's all over. Right? But out of compassion, because he's such a good guy, even when he has a chance to give him a knockout punch, he doesn't do that. Right? In that last moment where, you know, he's got the gun and he's got to shoot, he says, "Don't you ever try that again." And he throws the gun at the bad guy and he walks away, right? And you think, "Oh my God, he must be Mahatma Gandhi." Reincarnated. You begin to think. Because you've never seen such goodness in your life. You know, he was about to be shot. But that guy who got hold of the gun without shooting the guy who was about to shoot him, he drops the gun on that man just by the side of the man and he walks away. And then, now how are you left? How does that leave you? Nervous. Because what you know is going to happen next. Because they point the camera now at the bad guy and the gun. You know what's going to happen next, right? What's going to happen next? The bad guy is going to go do what? He's going to grab the gun. Now, but the good guy, he's got his back towards them and he's walking away. What do you want to do at that time? You want to shout out to the screen, don't you? Do you see the vexation working in your mind? I'm not just relating a story to you. I'm talking about what's happening to you at the same time. You know, we have to analyze what's going on. Why is a movie fun to watch? Why is it entertaining? Why is it called entertainment? How do you enjoy a movie? This is how you do so. This is how you do. So when the good guy walks away, you know, he's the hero, he's walking away with the girl with him now. He thinks that he saved the girl. The girl thinks that now they're safe. But the villain, he's got the gun next to him. He picks the gun up and he cocks it. And he points it at the good guy. And if you could shout out loud at that time, folks, you would shout out all the way to India. Because that's how much vexation has been built in your mind now. Because you want only good things to happen to the good people. You don't want bad things to happen to them. Because you love them. In that moment, they have become your family. They have become your friends. They have become part of your life. You want good only and only good to happen to them. So usually what will happen is, before the guy pulls the trigger or pulls the gun, he'll say, "Hey!" And then you wonder, I mean, what an idiot. I mean, if you want to shoot, you might as well just shoot, right? Why are you saying, "I'm warning you, I'm going to shoot you"? It's all part of the script to keep you in suspense. Real life never works like that. You know, a shooter doesn't say, "Hello, I'm going to shoot you at the count of three. One, two." It doesn't happen like that in real life. If you want someone dead, you want them dead now, not tomorrow. But the director knows that suspense is what keeps you on the edge of your seat and watching the film. Really, folks, the director's not directed the film. He's directing you, the viewer. He knows how to get a tear into your eye or out of your eye. He knows how to put a smile on your face. See, he calls the shots, quite literally. He decides when you should be happy. He decides when you should be edged. He decides when you should be angry, when you should be anxious, when you should be nervous, when you should be delighted. He decides all that. The director does, because the director knows how the mind works. Perhaps not in the way that the Buddha taught, but he understands that it is vexation that's going to keep you on the edge of your seat and glued to the film. And just before he pulls the trigger, they say what? Intermission. We'll be back after a short commercial break. How do you feel in that moment? Do you switch off the TV and walk away? Realistically? No. What do? You sit there waiting to be relieved of this suspense. That is the best time to show you the adverts. Because they know you will not get up and leave. So if you don't understand how the mind works, ladies and gentlemen, you will get abused. This is exploitation. But legal exploitation. It's all legal. It's all good. No one's going to bat an eyelid. But I have a problem with that. Because I know what you are going through. I know that you are going through suffering at that time. You are going through vexation. And I have a problem with that. But it's all legal. This is legal exploitation. Again, I have nothing against the directors. You know, this is not an insult or an attack to any of them. All I'm saying is, that is how the world works. And you are all guinea pigs. Until we understand the Dhamma. The truth is, it's not your choice what happens there. Because at that moment, you can't stand up and walk away. You have to be on your seat waiting to see what's going to happen next. So they show you all the adverts. Because you know you're going to watch it. Sorry, they know you're going to watch it. So a few moments later, the adverts are now done and they're back to the film. So this is the, this is the peak moment. Right? There's so much build up of tension. You don't know what's going to happen now. This is the climax. Right? This is the climax of the film. You don't know what's going to happen next. So in that moment, sometimes perhaps maybe he pulls the trigger. Or just before he pulls the trigger, there's someone else there. He shoots the gun with his gun. I mean, their focus is so sharp that they can shoot a gun with a single bullet that's about 2 kilometers away. Only in a story. Never happens in real life. Otherwise, you'd have to get a trained sniper to be able to do that. But this is just a standard guy. He gets a gun out and shoots. And in that moment, how do you feel? You were edged. You were really nervous. How do you feel in the moment that you realize, oh, thank God. It's a sigh of relief. Do you see how they take you on a roller coaster of emotions? Vexation and relief. Vexation and relief. Vexation and relief. This vexation is you wanting something to happen. So they build up this wanting in your mind and then they give it to you. Sometimes they make you feel that it's not going to happen. In those moments, your mind goes into a real sense, a real state of real, you know, great anxiety and fear. What about horror films? Anyone here enjoys watching horror films? I mean, they do it best. In horror films, they do it best. Because as the door opens and you hear the creak, what do you expect next? What do you expect behind the door? A spooky ghost? Or shaitan? The devil? Suspense. And someone comes and touches the shoulder, gives you a fright. Oh, it's only my mother. See, I need you to observe what you are going through as you watch it. You are being directed. You know, this is like a puppet show. It's all right to enjoy a puppet show as long as you are not the puppet. But when you watch a movie, are you not the puppet? You have given them the authority to do that. But the problem is, it is suffering that they create in your lives. Don't you feel angry when the villain beats the hero? Like when they start throwing a few punches, what do you also do? Don't you clench your fist as well and give a few extra punches? Just to be on the safe side? Tim. You know that is anger. Do you think anger is a meritorious deed? Now, people will say, but it's not real, Swaminas, it's just a film, so what gives? Some people ask me this question, what's so wrong with children playing computer games? And shooting games, and killing games, and thieving games. I don't want to name the game, but you know what I'm talking about. And shooting, and stealing, and murdering, and cutting, slicing people's throats up. People ask, what's so wrong with that if it's not real people? Anger is anger. Rage is rage. Hate is hate. There's a difference between karma and karma patha. There are two things. A karma patha is a karma that goes to completion. That can give you birth in a woeful state, in a woeful plane. What we call the four great hells. But a karma does not give you rebirth in a bad place, but it brings you suffering. Like you've seen people suffer, haven't you? Enough of that. People get burned. People get cuts and bruises. Excuse me. They break their arms, legs, accidents happen. They get hurt. They get beaten up. None of them are the result of a karma patha, but they are results of karmas, deeds, as you ask the question. What are the deeds? What are the results? For a deed to happen, or a karma to happen, I'll use the word karma because it's more familiar with all of us. I think the Anglican word deed does not quite contain the idea that I want to express. But a karma, because we're all familiar with that word, right? A karma and a vipaka. Yeah? So a karma, for a karma to happen, nothing needs to happen on the other side. So in fact, if you say, if you're angry and you shout at a deaf man, okay, you might think, well, that's all right, isn't it? Because he's deaf, he doesn't know you're shouting at him. It does not complete the karma to a karma patha. It does not elevate a karma to a karma patha, which brings you rebirth in a bad place. But it's karma nonetheless. Because what is karma? Intention is karma. Volition is karma. The intention that you have in your mind has no bearing, ladies and gentlemen, on what happens on the other side. If that were not the case, think about this. I'll prove the point to you. When you give alms, let's say, offer flowers to the Buddha. Is this a meritorious deed? Tell me. Is offering flowers to the Buddha a meritorious deed? Otherwise you wouldn't do it, would you? But aren't you offering flowers to a statue? Does the Buddha know that you've offered flowers? Is he happy about the fact that you've offered flowers? This is just a bit of cement. Or maybe plastic. Or maybe fiber. But does it still not earn you merits? How could it earn you merits if the Buddha had to be real to accept the flowers? If the Buddha had to be real for you to be earning merits, then I will agree that shooting and killing and murdering in a video game does not earn you demerit, because the person you are killing has to be real. You are coming off of flowers here. The Buddha is not real. We offer the Buddha puja. Perhaps at home you offer Buddha puja. At the monastery, we always do that. In the kuti that I live, every morning after I wake up, I offer a glass of water to the Buddha. Something so simple, something so easy to do. But the first offering I make every morning, just grateful for the fact that I'm still alive. And I commit myself to this day as well. I want to commit myself to the sasana. And do whatever I can to save myself and save others along the way. I offer a glass of water. And I resolve, as the glass of water is pure and cool, may I also be able to become pure and cool. These are all, as I said, everything has a meaning. It's not just water. Because one might ask, why do you offer a glass of water to a statue? The statue is not going to drink it. That's taken a very materialistic view of it. But we got to be able to expand and extend our thinking beyond that. In the food that you offer to the Buddha, it's not the statue that you're offering to, ladies and gentlemen. Because there's a difference between a karma and a karmapata. So when you offer alms to a monk, now think about it, you know, when you go to a temple and you take your food to offer to the Swaminarayan says, have you never been in the situation where sometimes the food that you have offered or you have cooked, prepared and brought to the temple and offered to the Swaminarayan, he has not eaten that day? Sometimes no one has served. Sometimes, you know, they have served it, or you've served it, but they've not eaten it. Because perhaps, you know, they're allergic to it, or maybe it's not something that, you know, that settles with them. Does that mean that you don't earn merits because the Swaminarayan has not consumed what you have offered them? Must the monk eat what you have offered them for you to earn merits? Of course not. Because karma is in the intention. It matters not whether the other party has consumed it or not. You know, I can only use one vatapata. I can only use one robe. But how many robes do you think get offered? You know, in a typical month, you think I go wearing all those robes? I got this robe about 1.5 years ago. And it's still fine. As long as it stays on my body and it doesn't fall off after I wear it, it's fine. It's not torn. I look after it. I take care of it. So it's fine. But I can't be wearing all the robes that people offer. Does that mean that the person who's offered the robe does not earn merit out of it? Of course not. So in the same way, ladies and gentlemen, if the mind experiences anger, when the mind experiences hate and jealousy, these are all demeritorious. This is all papa karma. But it's all legal. That's why in the films, it's legal. No one bats an eyelid. But as you watch it, as you feel anger towards the villain, you are accruing demerit. I know people will not want to hear me say this. And they will not like me saying this either. Perhaps, you know, if someone is in the film industry, they'll be plotting to shut Swaminarayan Sahib down. At this rate, I don't know what he's going to say next. Folks, I come to you with compassion because I want to help you save yourselves. If ever in your mind you feel anger towards someone, the deed has been done. The 10 unmeritorious deeds, Panatipata, Adinnadana, Kame Sumichachara, Musavada, Pisunavacha, Parushavacha, Samprapalapa, Vyapada. See, for theft to happen, right? Be it that you have to actually take something that belongs to someone. Okay, let's assume that the action actually has to qualify by you taking something that belongs to someone. But what about Vyapada? Vyapada is anger. Because there are defilements that happen through speech, unmeritorious deeds that happen through speech. There are four of them, three that happen through physical action, and three that happen in the mind. For something to happen in the mind, what needs to happen on the outside? Nothing. So Vyapada is anger, hatred. You know, the actual meaning of the word Vyapada is you want destruction to come to the other party, to the party towards whom you feel this malice, hatred. I think hatred would be a best fit for it. You hate them. When you watch a film, do you not experience hatred? You can call it anger, but it's on the verge of hatred. Do you not feel the intensity of emotions that runs through your mind? Do you not feel your veins swelling up and your heart pounding and beating faster? You know, so it's actually having an effect on your body. So the karma is being done, I'm sorry to say. I've sometimes seen, you know, people when there's a fight on the street, Right? What do people usually do? Please don't do it, ladies and gentlemen. You know, for your sake, please don't do these things. In case you've ever done it in the past, I appeal to you, never do it again, because you're doing yourself a huge disservice. When people are having a fight, what do people usually do? They'll stop. Sometimes they'll stop a driving car. They'll get out of the car, pull their windows down, and start washing it. They'll look at people fighting with each other. You know, there's a sport called wrestling. And later on they said it's not real wrestling, it's just action, right? So they renamed the thing to entertainment, right? Because you know what they do there, right? They attack people, they hit people in the head, they hit people in the groins, they jump on people, and sometimes they twist their arms, and you know, it's just havoc there, right? Complete anger and hatred. It may just be that actually they're just acting. It may be that they're just acting. In fact, at the end of the fight, they're best friends. They go for a drink. They're best friends. But what about the people who watch it? You take a side. Yeah, this is what our youth are going through right now. Please, let's do something to save them. Because as they watch it, you know, what they're watching is someone beating another guy. And what do they do? Do they say, how sad that is. Let's try and stop it. What do they do? Come on, that's it. Beat him up. Break his neck. Break his leg. Isn't that what they say? And if someone swings a chair at someone in the head, you know, there's laughter. They rejoice in it. They applaud. That's a good shot. You know, what are people rejoicing there? Remember Anathapindika, the story I told you right at the beginning? Right? When a monastery was offered to the Buddha, someone stood there and said, "Sadhu, sadhu." And what did he earn? He never offered a penny, ladies and gentlemen. What did he earn? A palace. Now just think about two people having a fight. That could just be an act. But the person watching it, he rejoices. She rejoices in that violence. And says, "Sadhu, sadhu." Parents, why do you put your children through this? I mean, this is child abuse. If you as parents put your children through this, this is child abuse. We need to become more responsible as adults. You know, younger years, we didn't have this. We didn't have all this entertainment on TV. Like I said, my great-grandfather, he didn't have a TV. He didn't know what a TV was. But, you know, now all of this is just so freely available. That is why last week I told you, we no longer have the time to look after our children, because we are far too busy and our children are being ruined and spoiled. Let's not let that happen under our noses. Let's do something about it. I can't change the world, but I can help you save yourselves and your children by showing you the facts. Again, I'll emphasize this again. Please don't take anything I say at face value. I try and prove everything to you as best as I can. Because I don't expect any of you to take anything I say so just because I say so. If playing a video game and stabbing someone in the body is not demeritorious, if it is not demeritorious, then offering a Buddha puja is not meritorious either. Then stop doing it. You have to admit. I mean, they both can't be true at the same time, right? If one is true, the other also has to be true. So if ever, you know, as parents, I appeal to the parents here, right? If you as parents are parents to young children, please protect them. You brought them into this world to do good to them. Perhaps today you don't know where they were before you brought them here. One day I'll explain to you where they were before you brought them here. And how fortunate they are to have been born as human beings. But now that you brought them here, it's your responsibility to look after them. Make use of us. Let us help. Because the Dhamma is here to help. But please protect them. You have the responsibility to do that. So just because it's the easy thing to do, don't let them just go and play any old computer games. If your children ask, can I play computer games? As a responsible adult, make sure that the games they are playing are not harmful to them. If they ask to watch a movie, then, you know, as a responsible adult, make sure that you know what kind of movie they are watching. Because if it's sex and violence they are watching, then every time that passes through their mind, that is what the mind adjusts to. That's what the mind acquires. And eventually, you're going to end up with a child that is who is unruly. You won't be able to control them. At one point, it's just going to go past that threshold. And then they will no longer listen to what you say. Because this is just a mind. It's not a child. It's a mind. The mind is like a machine. What you feed it is how the mind works. Anyhow, I digress. Let's come back to the film. I think I care too much. So sometimes I go on a sidetrack. Right, let's come back to the film. When you watch the film, that they show you this violence, this you know, scenes of violence, right? And in those moments, the mind goes into that state of anger and hate and jealousy and so on. But these are all vexations. So eventually, when what you want is presented to you, meaning the villain is killed, right, and the boy and the girl are reunited. Or maybe a child got kidnapped and somehow they were able to reclaim the child. Right? When that happens, now you can breathe a sigh of relief. See, it's a roller coaster. Ultimately, what the movie has been is when you started, you didn't have any of these problems, did you? All the frustrations and the disappointments and the waiting and the longing for, you didn't have that at the start of the film, right? So the director very carefully, very skillfully, very tactfully took you on a journey of vexation and relief, vexation and relief, vexation and relief. And in the end, he leaves you relieved. In the end, he leaves you relieved unless there's a part two coming. Yes. What happens if there's a part two? Where do they leave you? On a cliffhanger. If there's a part two, then although the guy was shot dead, or at least you thought he was dead, as everyone walks out of the scene, the camera will focus at this dead man, or the person you think who's dead. And his hand will move. And that will be the end. Now the director knows one thing for certain. When part two comes, where will you be? In the cinema hall. Puppets. I mean, I used to be the biggest puppet. That is what gives me the right to invite you to be members of that association. See what they do? You know, in the end, if you take the whole picture and analyze what's happened, you paid your hard-earned money at the cinema because you didn't have problems in your life. Or in fact, you had problems, but you wanted to forget your problems. Right, your mother is poorly, she's ailing, right? Your daughter's failed her exam, your son is in another relationship and you want him to stop, your husband is beating you up or something, right? And you just want a moment to forget about the problems in life so you can just, you know, just forget about all that and just take a moment of going to a fairyland. Take a holiday. Huh? Just for a couple of hours at least. And for that, you go into the cinema, you pay your hard-earned money and say, "Excuse me, please can you take my money?" And create a world in which I can live so that I forget all the problems in my life. You know, they do this deliberately. In some countries which I shall not name, but I think is obvious to you, right? In some countries, they do this deliberately so that the authorities, the government can rule their people. So they don't have to deal about poverty. I mean, they do deal with poverty, but they can't be dealing with it at the rate at which people fall into poverty. People have all sorts of problems. They don't have literacy. They live in poverty, right? They don't have the access to education. They don't have access to health. And all some of the most basic resources that you would expect to be given to people as basic human rights. Because people don't have, the government doesn't have the resources to provide all that, what they do is they give people a fantasy world in which they can live. Every month there'll be at least 2 or 3 films you can go and watch. And for the duration of the film, you're just in that world, you forget all the problems you have, but after you come out of that, for 1 week you can live in the memory of the film. You can, when you meet your friends, you'll talk about Amitabh Bachchan. Oh, did I just give that out? You'll talk about, you know, Shah Rukh Khan and Salman Khan and Juhi Chawla and this Chawla and that Chawla and what all the things that happened in the film. You know, you just talk about that amongst your friends, amongst your family. And then, you know, when reality starts to come back to life, you begin to think, oh, hang on a second, I have a debt to pay. Hang on a second, I need to go and find some money to heal my mother's disease. You know, she's got a condition, I need to go and find money for that. And then another film comes along. You know, this is like the betting center. You know how people live at the betting center, right? You know, they go to the betting center, they bet some money, ever hopeful that they're going to win. The first time they win. That's how it happens. The first time they give you... You win something. The odds are in your favor. The first time you win, and now you're hopeful that every time you're going to win. So what do? Whatever winning you've got, winning money, you put back into it. I have not seen any man who's become rich by going to the betting parlor. Have you? I'll tell you who's rich. The people who run those places. I've got nothing against them, by the way. Long may they prosper. Because that is not who I have a problem with. What I have a problem with is when you are used as a scapegoat, when you are used as puppets because of a lack of understanding of the Dhamma. I can explain the same concept. If you ever ridden a roller coaster, it's the same thing that happens. Again, myself, I used to enjoy roller coasters until I realized what the heck was going on. How does one enjoy a roller coaster ride? You stand in queue. Sometimes the queue is how long? Sometimes you have to stand a whole hour in the queue. I mean, when I used to live in England, I went to each and every theme park there was, because I so enjoyed going on roller coasters and those rides until I listened to the Dhamma, and then I realized, my God, I was cheated in broad daylight. So you'd stand in the queue, sometimes you can get a fast track ticket, right? But you stand in queue, right? Because you can hear all the screams and the people coming out of the ride smiling, laughing. And you wonder, well, surely I'm also going to be able to experience that joy and that laughter, right? But little do we realize that laughter comes after something else. You have to experience it to know it. So you stand in the queue, you get into the cart, and then they say, please fasten your seatbelts. Please, you know, if you're pregnant or, you know, if you've got a heart attack, please make sure you get out and inform the member of staff so you don't have to continue on this ride. So they give you all the safety instructions. You fasten the seatbelt, you know, brace yourself. And then what do? They give you the scare of your life. Give me a show of hands if you've been on a roller coaster. None of you? Oh, that's better. Okay. So what do? Right? They take you up. I went on this roller coaster called the Stealth. It was in Alton Towers or Thorpe Park or somewhere in England. So they take you up this ride. It's almost half a kilometer. But they take you up, right? And then they show you God. Or at least they make you think of God at that time. When you're up there, and then they turn you down to see the ground below. Now that's the time when you start chanting what? Itipiso, Bhagava, Araham. No, it's true. Don't you ask yourself that question at that point? Why did I sign up for this? Why did I get onto this? And how you howl fast the seat belts and the metal and your cage that has been given for you. You make sure it's all working. It's all been fastened tight. Some people faint because they can't take it. But when you're right up there, fear takes over you. And in that moment, you forget all the problems in your life. Don't you? See, that is why it's called entertainment. It's called entertainment because it makes you forget the problems in your life. It's like taking drugs. When you are drugged, I'm not going to say put your hand up if you ever tried it. Right? I don't want to insult anyone. Right? But if you ever take... No, sorry. Didn't mean to say that. When you are drugged, you forget problems in life. Some people start taking drugs because of that. Because they have debts to pay. They have a broken relationship. And then they suffer because of that. Mother's got cancer. All sorts of problems. Debtors warning you and debtors threatening you to kick you out of your house. At the workplace they've said in 1 week's time we're going to kick you out, we're going to give you the sack. Right? So all sorts of problems and people start taking drugs. But when you are drugged, you go into this fantasy world. It just knocks you out, right? So no problem. When you don't know what's going on, it's as if there are no problems in life. So when you are in intense sense of fear, sensuality is the same. We'll talk about it another time. When you're in an intense sense of fear, there's no time to focus on anything else. That fear completely overtakes you. Do you remember that time when you felt that you were pulling up, you were moving too fast and the car in front of you had braked and you had to apply the emergency brakes? If you ever experienced that? Right, where the guy has just stopped in the middle of the road and you're driving up fast and you realize, oh my God, I better slam the brakes, otherwise I'm going to crash into this guy. Do you remember about the exam that you have tomorrow at that time? Do you remember about the bills you have to pay? Oh, who's going to cook lunch tonight? Tomorrow? You don't remember any of these things because in that moment, fear takes over you. Fear has the ability to do that. It has the ability to make you forget your problems. So people pay for that. So up on the ride, you look down and you think, why did I get on this ride? And then, slowly, they take you back down to earth. And as you get out of the ride, what are you happy about? Honestly answer this question. What are you really happy about? You are happy that you are still in one piece, right? Let's be honest. That is what you are happy about. You are happy that you are safe. You are happy that it was, all that fear you no longer have to endure. You are safe now. So who put yourself in that? And why put yourself in that? In the end, what have you really done? You earned your hard money, your hard-earned money. You've gone up to them and you said, here, take this money. Right? And fear the living daylights, scare the living daylights out of me, right? And please bring me back to my senses again. And I will pay you for that. This is how you enjoy a thrill ride or a joy ride. It's the relief from vexation again. You didn't experience that joy at the beginning of the ride, did you? Just when you were getting into the cart, did you experience that joy? No. So for that joy, where did it come from? Where did the pleasure come from? No pain, no gain. So you had to put yourself through the pain first to then be relieved of the pain, and now you're back where you started. Because you know what they do as soon as you get off? They turn the cart around and then another bunch of people sit down and they send them back on the same ride. And you walk away saying, idiots. Yeah, well, that's what the last lot talked about you. That's what the last lot said about you. You know, I've been there, done that, bought the t-shirt. I know what this feels like. Yeah. I was such a stupid person. I'm sharing this with you, ladies and gentlemen, because I you know, you don't have to put yourself through this. Even if you go and enjoy your rights, you know, that's okay. But what I'm saying is, let's please understand where pleasure comes from. It is not inherent in a ride. Pleasure can only come where there is pain to be relieved from. So what people do is when they don't have pain, they first inflict pain upon themselves and they find a way to come out of it. Crazy or crazy? Which one? That is what a film is. That is what a horror movie is. That is what a ride is. You first inflict pain upon yourselves and then you find a way to relieve yourself from it. I mean, why would you do that? Because pleasure is so overrated. For people who don't understand how to be happy, they try to be happy. And these are some of the things you do trying to be happy. See? How wrong we've gone and how far wrong we've gone trying to be happy. And there's always a risk. You know that, you know, these rides have not always gone to plan. There have been times where serious accidents have happened. Sometimes you see them on the newspapers. Right? The theme park, they've shut for a long period of time while they're doing some investigations as to how some of those things happened. And then they have inquiries and the police get involved and all sorts. But, you know, the police can go and come and do the inquiries. The staff, they can pay the compensation. But for the person who lost their life, what compensation? And you know the worst part of it is, they died with fear in their minds, not happy. So if you're serious about Nibbana, personally, I would never walk that way again. Not to a ride. But hey, that's just my tuppence worth. I would not go that way. Because if ever that goes wrong, right, and you die with fear. Places where people are born when they die with fear are not very nice places. Whether you believe about the afterlife or not. If you don't believe in the afterlife, still, you've died not with a smile on your face, but with a scream. That's a very sad way to go, isn't it? And all for nothing. All for nothing. What you've paid them money for is to insert fear into your minds and then relieve you from it. A problem that you didn't have. This is self-inflicted torture, if you ask me. Self-mortification. Again, what the Buddha said, you mustn't do. See, time and time again, ladies and gentlemen, I'm giving you examples of how the pleasure that you have experienced in your life so far has always been because of relief from vexation. When you cross the street, if there's a vehicle coming up to you, approaching you, right, and you somehow run fast and cross the road and you're just saved, by the skin of your teeth. If you're just saved like that, you know, do you not feel that relief? Huh? Oh my God, you know, I almost got into an accident. That almost crashed into me, and I'm so glad I was saved. I feel so lucky to have been saved. You say that about yourself. You say that about other people when you saw it happen to them. That moment was a moment of pleasure. Why pleasure? Because you were just relieved from fear, from pain, from suffering. That is the experience of pleasure. So don't fall into the trap of pleasure. There is a different kind of happiness that we can have. There is a different kind of happiness we can have. So you don't have to opt in for pleasure when there is happiness. Happiness and pleasure are two very different things. So I want to conclude on that for today. Happiness and pleasure are very two different things. They're very different. They're worlds apart. Whatever you have experienced in your life up until now, wherever the case has been that there was pain before the experience of joy, that is a case of pleasure, not happiness. The Buddha's doctrine helps you to attain happiness. This happiness is unconditional happiness. Do you see how the pleasure that you have experienced is always conditional? Meaning, there are conditions that have to go in your favor before you experience that pleasure. If it's your life, it has to be saved. If it's fear, you have to be given freedom from it. If it's pain, you have to be relieved from it. So there are conditions that have to work in your favor. If you ask her, she has to say yes. See, these are the conditions. If it's an exam, you have to get a pass. See, these are the conditions. If it's a test, it has to come back negative. These are the conditions of your happiness. If you apply for the loan, they have to say yes. If you go looking for the property and you've set your mind on it and you've come to an agreement, they have to come back and say, yes, it's yours. See, these are the conditions. Remember the last time you lost something? I'll leave you with that. Remember the last time you lost something? It could have been anything. You know, a bunch of keys, maybe a shirt, maybe your watch, a wallet, your phone, right? Remember the last time you lost that? And then you went around the house looking for it. When you found it, how did you feel? What was the feeling when you found something you'd lost? Maybe a child. You were out on the street, right? Maybe doing shopping in the boulevard, and your child ran away. Perhaps some parents here might have that experience. You were in the middle of a busy street, and your child ran away. And then you went around looking for your child. And eventually you found him. Or you found her. You found your keys. You found your car. You found your wallet. You found your phone. How did you feel? What's the word? Relieved. Yeah? You felt relieved. If this was what you lost, you can substitute this with anything. If this was what you lost, so keys, child, phone, wallet, whatever. Okay? If this was what you lost, upon finding it, you felt relief. You thought it was this that gave you that pleasure. Then where was the pleasure before you lost it? Question. Where was that pleasure before you lost it? This is your wallet. Okay? You got it with you now. Right? Imagine you have your wallet in your hand. If you have a look at it, it's not going to give you that much pleasure. But lose it and then find it. I mean, you can't lose it yourself and find it because then, of course, you haven't lost it. But imagine you actually lost it. And you went around the house looking for it, looked in the kitchen, in the fridge, you know, in the washing machine. You looked for it everywhere. And maybe 2 days later, someone came and handed it over to you. And what do you say? Oh my God, you know, you are God. Thank you so much. I've been looking for this so long. Thank you so much. How can I thank you? I can't thank you enough. Because just the sight of it gives you so much pleasure, but that pleasure you didn't experience before you lost it, did you? So is it the wallet then that gave you that pleasure? Is it the pair of keys or the bunch of keys? Is it your child? No. What happened when you lost it? Vexation. In other words, you want something and it's not there. But when you have it with you, you want it and it's there. Whenever you want something and you don't have it, your mind goes into vexation. And it's longing for it, it's waiting for it, it's looking everywhere for it. And then eventually you find it. And what you are relieved from is that buildup of vexation. What you experience as pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, here's the last thing I'm going to say. What you experience as pleasure is not something that the object can give you. Because if it could, it would give it to you all the time you have it in your possession. It doesn't give you because it's not inbuilt. It's not an attribute of this object. You only experience pleasure when you are relieved from pain, when you are relieved from vexation. That's why I say pleasure is so overrated. If you live your life having sought refuge in pleasure, that's a very sorry life to live. There is an alternative. That alternative is the noble bliss that the Buddha speaks of. To attain that bliss, we need to understand the Four Noble Truths. Now, do you all understand that there is a difference between pleasure and the happiness? That it can't be one and the same? But you can't tell me that the Buddha was happy because he walked around finding things he'd lost. Right? That can't be why the Buddha was happy. Because if you find it and it was lost, it is conditional happiness, isn't it? It's based on the condition of you finding it. See, so it's conditional. But an unconditional happiness is a happiness that cannot be taken from you. Nothing in this world can take it away from you. It's always yours. You don't have to lose anything and find it to experience that. You don't have to have the fear of life or the fear of death and then be freed from it to experience that. It's just always there with you. That is the happiness I'm going to talk to you about from here on. So to do that, we have to explore and understand the Four Noble Truths. And so we'll continue our journey when we meet again next week. Now, last week the time was wrong on the clock. What time is it now? Ah, okay. So you got the right time today. One day I'll teach you that time is not real. It's just fake. Time is a measure that is used by a diseased mind to measure existence, an existence that is not real. That was a cliffhanger. See, I'm also a nice director, aren't I? Alright, I'll see you puppets next week then. Huh? Alright, let's transfer the merits we have all acquired. And as we do so, ladies and gentlemen, I want you all to rejoice in everything that you see around here. You know, setting this up itself was a meritorious deed. Because it's because of this you are able to listen to this sermon. It might not have been you who set it up. But do you see a good deed has been done? Rejoice in that. The flowers that have been arranged here, it's not for me. It's so that you can delight in it. You know, pleasant thoughts appear in your mind as you listen to the sermon. It's all for that. The invitation to preach the Dhamma. The Buddha statue here. The pavada that has been laid down. The room, the chairs. Everything here, you know, the refreshments you're going to get later on. It might be that you never did any of it, but someone did it. Matters not who did it, but the good deed has been done. Let's all rejoice in the good deeds. And it matters not who did it. Okay. So first and foremost then, let us all remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching. And with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer all the merits we have acquired today to all of them. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to the chief prelates of all of the... Let us take a moment to transfer the merits to all the members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who have dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us not forget that amongst them are the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer message to all those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. And may by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits, to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes everyone from those of you who have supported the construction of the monastery, as well as those who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who have passed on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May by the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer message to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, uncles, aunts, nephews, nieces, our grandparents, our friends and our acquaintances, our employers, employees, and to all those who have helped us, supported us, and assisted us in any way, shape or form possible and available to them. May by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who are committed to protect and fulfill the Samudhasasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May by the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to all those who passed away in our name, our loved ones, our ancestors, and those who have predeceased us. By the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, may they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer merits to the members of the armed forces as well as the police force, those who have sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation and continue to do so. Let us remind ourselves that it is because of their sacrifice today we are able to listen to the sermons, practice the Dhamma and attain to Nibbana in peace and harmony. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to all of them. Let us also transfer these merits to those who might have lost their lives in the war, be they friend or foe. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who might have lost their lives to natural calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, forest fires, pandemics, and so on. By the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, may they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plain. May by the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, by the power of these merits, may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become an arahatun vahanse, or an arahattaranin vahanse, in this very life itself, and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha himself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you all. Raga ginnen midetnva, dvesha ginnen midetnva, moha ginnen midetnva, nibbana parama sukhayen Sukhita Taravitnva Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravitnva Mamada Siyalu Loka Siyalu Satnvayo Nibbana Parama Sukhayan सुखित तार विद्वा निब्बान परम सुखयन सुखित तार विद्वा निब्बान परम सुखयन सुखित तार विद्वा राग गिनी निवेवा द्वेष गिनी निवेवा मोह गिनी निवेवा निवंसत देवा निवंसत देवा निवंसत देवा तुंडुवन्गे सुविसि अनंत महा गुण बलेन सीलु लोक सीलु सत्वयोम निब्बान परम सुखेन सुखित तर वेत्वा साधु साधु साधु।